Wayne News.
WFP received 100 million, so that's allowing us now to get food into the country very quickly, but we still have a huge shortfall.
Staving off hunger in Afghanistan. It's Wednesday, October 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Mimi Heibels in Washington. You can also find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, what's at stake at the COP26 climate summit? COVID-19 outbreak at Australian Immigration Detention Hotel. Examining long COVID. Beijing ramps up space diplomacy. Artificial intelligence helps musicians learn to play. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Afghanistan is facing a severe food shortage. With winter coming, supply lines to large parts of the country will be cut off by snow. Aid agencies say they are rushing to stave off crippling hunger and malnutrition in freezing cold temperatures. VOA's Aisha Tanzim met Afghan families struggling to feed their children. This is their story.
A hungry child crying for milk, a common sight in today's Afghanistan. International aid agencies say more than half of the country's population, a record 22.8 million people, face acute hunger in the coming months. That includes millions of children. Two such children live with Seema in Kabul.
Previously, when their father worked, we used to give these children a bottle of milk each, twice a day. Now both of them share one bottle of milk for the whole day. Two bottles last 48 hours.
Everyone in this household, mother, father, son, and daughter, have lost their jobs. With no income, putting food on the table is a challenge, Seema says.
It's been 3 weeks since we cooked a meal. We only eat dry bread. But if we eat it in the afternoon, we don't have anything for dinner. If we eat it for dinner, we don't have anything for breakfast.
4 decades of war has left the country destitute. Nearly three-fourths of the Afghan government's budget was supported by foreign funding. That funding stopped when the Taliban took over. The United States has also frozen nearly $10 billion of Afghanistan's assets. Now, the country is facing an economic meltdown. At a food distribution center in Kabul, set up by the World Food Program, the lines are long. Mary Ellen McGroarty is the country director of WFP in Afghanistan.
WFP received 100 million, so that's allowing us now to get food into the country very quickly. But we still have a huge shortfall as we approach into winter. You know, we need another 100 million now before the end of the year and 300 million going into the beginning of 2022.
The situation has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic and a severe drought, the second in 4 years. Many have lost their jobs. Many with jobs have not been paid in months. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced by conflict and drought. Nazia is one such displaced person.
I used to have food and clothes, but when I fled, I couldn't bring anything with me. Even my feet are injured.
Afghanistan is now among the world's worst humanitarian crises. The aid rations allow families like this one to have a decent meal, but not for long. Whatever help they're getting today will only last them a month. And with the winter coming, they don't know how they will survive the year. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. China urges U.S.-led West to engage with Taliban, lift sanctions. Japanese princess marries commoner, gives up royal status. Ex-South Korean president Ro Tae-woo dies at 88. Myanmar skips ASEAN summit after its military ruler excluded. Climate holdout Australia sets 2050 net zero emissions target. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Global pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions are just a fraction of what's needed to prevent catastrophic global warming. That's the warning from the United Nations ahead of the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Britain next week, where world leaders will try to agree on further action to combat global warming. Henry Ridgewell looks at what's at stake ahead of the meeting for VOA.
At the 2015 Paris Climate Summit, world leaders pledged to restrict global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But those promises are not being matched with policies, according to the United Nations Emissions Gap Report published Tuesday. It warns that new commitments to reduce emissions made in the run-up to the Glasgow summit, known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, will reduce greenhouse gases by just 7.5% by 2030 compared to previous pledges. Restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require emissions cuts of 55%. Petteri Tallas is the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization.
So far, we have heard lots of political support for enhanced ambition of mitigation, but the concrete pledges have still been missing. And at the moment, we are heading towards 2.5 to 3 degrees warming rather than 1.5 to 2 degrees.
So what does that mean for the planet and for humankind? Scientists say climate change is already increasing the frequency and intensity of heat waves. A recent report from Chatham House calculated that globally, heat-related mortality has increased by nearly 54% among the elderly since the turn of the century, reaching 296,000 deaths in 2018. Daniel Quiggin is a co-author of the report.
We expect around about 400 million people to be experiencing heat waves to the extent that they're no longer able to work outside.
Heat waves and droughts would have a big impact on global food security. Crop failures and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases, such as the locust plague in East Africa last year, would lead to soaring prices. Again, Daniel Quiggin.
Over the next 30 years, about 50% more food is going to be required due to more people being on the planet, but also expectations around eating more meat, particularly in countries like China and Southeast Asia and so on and so on. But at the same time, under our assessment, we anticipate yields, harvests, to decline by around about 30%.
Warmer temperatures lead to more intense tropical storms and flooding. Longer term, melting ice caps will lead to sea level rises, putting coastal cities at risk. Extreme weather fluctuations also mean more intense and more prolonged droughts. Scientists say richer nations must deliver on their 2015 promise to help poorer nations pay for combating climate change and deal with its impacts. Again, Daniel Quiggin.
The big cascading impacts that we see coming out of drought, heat waves, agricultural drought, are migration, food insecurity for everyone, and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases. So there's a vested interest for those wealthy countries to ensure that the climate finance, that $100 billion per year that's been pledged for some time since Paris and before, is actually delivered upon. And it's not being delivered upon at the moment.
As world leaders prepare for Glasgow, the stakes for our planet and for the human race are getting higher. The impacts close to irreversible. Can a new global agreement be reached to slash emissions well beyond current commitments? Summit host British Prime Minister Boris Johnson gave his assessment Monday.
I'm very worried because it might go wrong, and we might not get the agreements that we need. And it's touch and go. It's very, very difficult.
Scientists say the outcome of the Glasgow summit will likely affect each and every one of us on a warming planet Earth. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Still ahead on VOA Asia, more on a COVID-19 outbreak at an Australian immigration detention hotel. Happening now in Asia, the United Nations Secretary General announced the appointment Monday of Singaporean Nolene Heiser as his new special envoy on Myanmar. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're so glad you decided to join us on VOA Asia. At least 20 asylum seekers have tested positive for COVID-19 while being detained at a hotel in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports for VOA.
About 46 male asylum seekers have been detained at the Park Hotel in Melbourne. Almost half have tested positive for COVID-19. Some are reportedly immunocompromised, including one detainee who has burns to more than half of his body after he set himself on fire at an offshore processing facility. The detainees were flown in from Australian offshore migrant camps in Papua New Guinea and Nauru during the past 2 years, mostly for medical treatment. The Australian Border Force, which operates the hotel detention facility, says those who are unwell have been closely monitored and given proper medical care. A media release states that multiple nursing staff are on site and a general practitioner has attended the site and is available via telehealth at all times. It adds that all detainees in Australian immigration detention facilities have been offered COVID-19 vaccinations. However, refugee advocates tell a different story. They insist the hotel has become an incubator for the virus and that nursing staff work only during the day. Ian Rintoul, a spokesperson for the Refugee Action Coalition, a community campaign organisation, describes conditions inside the hotel as a national scandal.
There is one who's been hospitalised quite seriously. People have serious symptoms, chest pain. Some people are quite unwell, others are, you know, mild symptoms. The idea that they're being monitored regularly is just nonsense. They've got no access to fresh air, no access to exercise. It is not a proper facility to be isolating people.
Almost every asylum seeker in the Melbourne hotel has been detained by Australia for more than 8 years. A 2013 policy barred any migrant trying to reach Australia by sea from resettlement. Papua New Guinea was one of two Pacific countries paid by Canberra, along with the small Pacific Republic of Nauru, to detain asylum seekers and refugees. The agreement with Papua New Guinea, or PNG, is scheduled to finish at the end of the year. Migrants there will either be transferred to Nauru or be allowed to resettle in PNG. Australia grants resettlement visas to about 13,700 refugees each year under various humanitarian schemes. Australia has detected 160,000 coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. More than 1,600 people have died. 74% of the eligible population is fully vaccinated, and long lockdowns in Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne were recently lifted. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Be sure to read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Amnesty International announced Monday it would shut its two offices in Hong Kong, citing concerns about the city's sweeping national security law. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Chronic fatigue, brain fog, insomnia, heart problems, and difficulties breathing. These are just some of the symptoms of long COVID. Lisa Bacaliotz looked into what long COVID really is and how U.S. doctors are treating the condition. Her report is narrated by VOA's Anna Rice.
Even after recovering from COVID-19, many people report lingering effects for months later. According to a report by Fair Health, a nonprofit organization focused on transparency in healthcare, about 15-20% of those who have contracted the virus continue to have symptoms months later. 14-year-old Sienna from Cleveland got COVID about a year ago.
Oh, my smells came back, but they came back all like completely different, like distorted and everything. So like regular foods tasted like, I always describe it as burning rubber, like this really weird smell.
Doctors call such a long rehabilitation process long COVID. The World Health Organization calls the lingering symptoms post-COVID.
It occurs in individuals with a history of probable or confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infection, usually 3 months from the onset of the COVID-19, with symptoms that last for at least 2 months and cannot be explained by an alternative diagnosis.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lists 18 common symptoms, including cough, headaches, shortness of breath, insomnia, heart palpitations, and oftentimes chronic fatigue.
Fatigue is a really common symptom. It's a really dominant one. And the fatigue often is coupled with brain, what patients describe as, quote, brain fog, which would be difficulty concentrating, cognitive issues, cloudiness.
Dr. Linda Jiang works with post-COVID patients at a Stanford University clinic. One challenge is making sure these common symptoms are post-COVID and not something else.
And there's a clear time correlation of persistence of symptoms that they didn't have before COVID, and there weren't other coinciding events that occurred or health changes, then it sort of eliminates the other possibilities.
The number of long COVID centers has mushroomed across the U.S. Social media support groups are also helping patients deal with the mental impact of post-COVID symptoms. Experts say mood swings, anxiety, and depression are very common. Former nurse Lainey Bond says her support group gains an additional 1,500 people a week.
We're really focused on what we would call a nursing patient education.
The U.S. National Institutes of Health have launched a $470 million project aimed at learning more about post-COVID symptoms and finding a treatment. For Lesa Bokalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia. In a rare joint appeal, the leaders of Pakistan and China on Tuesday urged the international community to swiftly send humanitarian and economic aid to Afghanistan, where people are facing food and medicine shortages as winter approaches. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, after successfully launching its second manned spaceship of its space station program on October 16th, the three-person crew will live on China's space station for 6 months, a new milestone for a program that has advanced rapidly in recent years. In the China-U.S. space race, Beijing is ramping up space diplomacy. VOA Asia takes a closer look at China's plans to invite foreign astronauts to its space station due for completion by the end of 2022. Experts say China is extending its space program to other countries in ways that its superpower rival, the United States, finds hard to match and that stand to isolate the U.S. on Earth. The vehicle propelling Beijing's international plans for space diplomacy, the Shenzhou 13, blasted off with a crew of three on board. The spacecraft is the core module of China's space station and will stay in space for 6 months. State-run Xinhua News Agency says this journey begins the longest space flight ever for China. The crew will check all space station systems and help complete its construction by the end of next year. The Beijing-based China Daily News website said the space station will become a platform for deeper international cooperation and welcome foreign astronauts. Marco Caceres, the director of space studies at the Thiel Group market analysis firm, believes this is a positive development for China.
My sense is that this is good PR for China. Already you see that there is a space race developing between the U.S. and China.
He adds that Washington believes Beijing to be extremely aggressive in space. A 2011 U.S. law bars NASA from using its funds to engage the Chinese government and affiliated organizations without congressional and FBI approval. Experts say China's outreach to other countries goes beyond PR. China builds high-end satellites for developing countries and shares satellite data to help with relief work after natural disasters. NASA says as of 2008, China has signed space-related cooperation agreements with Argentina, Brazil, Canada, France, Malaysia, Pakistan, Russia, Ukraine, and the European Commission. Yan Sun is the co-director of the East Asia program at the Stimson Center in Washington. She says China offered remote sensing data to Japan after the 2011 tsunami, has given images to Australia for wildfire damage surveys, and Chinese satellites have provided free Earth imagery to developing countries.
It sounds like the data collected by these type of satellites are quite a popular and needed commodity or data for many countries. So for developing countries who don't have the access to commercial satellite or information to be shared by Western countries, then China provides a useful alternative.
Russia and China tentatively agreed in September to open a joint lunar research base. Alexander Vu Ving, a professor at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii, had this to say about China's role.
When China invites other countries to its own space station, then of course China will be the leader. So it's demonstrate China's leadership willingness and leadership's capability, as well as its high-tech capabilities, to show that China can rival even the United States and Russia and the European Union.
Washington's role in the International Space Station has put its 60-year-old space program in contact with agencies from Russia, Europe, Japan, and Canada. In 2013, the government removed satellite technology from a list of export-controlled items to help manufacturers compete overseas. But Vu Ving says the United States prioritizes space competition less now than during the Cold War. NASA did not answer a request for comment. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. I'm Amy Heibels in Washington. And in tech news, a popular new music app uses artificial intelligence to democratize how musicians of all skill levels learn and play music. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
Eloy Casagrande has been playing the drums since he was 7 years old, a passion he's developed into a successful career. He recently discovered a music app that allows users to remove any elements of a fully mixed song, including vocals and individual instruments, which he demonstrates in this video.
No drums anymore.
He spoke with VOA via Skype.
Since I was a kid and I wanted to play a cover, to learn a song in the drums, I had like to record on top of the original drummer. Now I'm able to choose any song to remove the drums. I can create my own drums.
The goal of the app is to give artists of all skill levels access to cutting-edge audio technologies, says its creator, Geraldo Ramos, who spoke with VOA via Skype.
So artificial intelligence comes in, and with a technology called machine learning, we're able to train an algorithm to separate that instruments after it's mixed out.
The technology has been available for music production for a while, says Ramos, but was simply inaccessible to the everyday musician.
So imagine it like we are a universal karaoke machine where anyone can upload a song and then adjust the song the way they want to.
Legal experts point out that whenever there's a new technology that works with music, there could be copyright concerns. Paul Fackler is a partner at the New York law firm of Mayer Brown, with a focus on copyright law.
So it's clearly a very useful app, like for learning music in your bedroom. On the other hand, if users then turn around and distribute recordings that they make using other people's music, that's when you get into the more troubling gray area.
Ramos says users of the app should pay close attention to the terms of use posted on the app's website. Since its launch in 2019, the company has grown to more than 6 million users worldwide, making it one of the most popular music apps on iOS and Android platforms, according to ranking numbers from Apple App Store and Google Play. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can also find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Chris Cascao, Keith Lane, Jessica Stone, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Amy Heibels. Now go and make it a great day.